Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. So today, I'm really excited to have my buddy David Chalmers on the podcast. David is a philosopher at New York University and the Australian National University. Officially, he's professor of philosophy and co-director of the Center for Mind, Brain, and Consciousness at NYU, and about 20% of the time, he's professor of philosophy at ANU. His work is in the philosophy of mind and in related areas of philosophy and cognitive science. He's especially interested in consciousness, but he's also interested in all sorts of other issues in the philosophy of mind and language, metaphysics and epistemology, and the foundations of cognitive science. I just had a nerdgasm there with all those words. Thanks, David, so much for chatting with me tonight.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here with you on your podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about, you know, how I wanted to get you on the podcast and such. You know, I promised you I wouldn't just ask all the standard questions, you know, that everyone always asks you over and over again. What is consciousness? What is free will? You know, but I think what is really interesting is that you're telling me that you estimate about 30% probability that we are living in the Matrix. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I go back and forth anywhere between 10% and 50%, but definitely greater than zero. Definitely some chance. What do you think?
Those are big numbers.
Yeah.
I never estimated it as that high, but I think that we need to like really totally define our terms and tell me what living the Matrix would mean to you.
Well, the extreme case is that of an entirely simulated universe. So, you know, right now we know how to make simulated worlds like virtual reality. You know, there's SimCity or SimLife or SimEarth. But the extreme case is simulating the whole universe, Sim Universe, if you like. Then there's really two ways this could go. It could be a simulation that we go into that we're interacting with. You know, our brain is outside the simulation. That's how it goes with ordinary virtual reality. And that's how it was for Neo in the movie The Matrix. His brain was outside the simulation. Or it could be that the brain is simulated too, and we are ourselves entirely creatures of the simulation. And it could be that as technology goes on, people are going to make simulations of universes like this, of both of those forms. And that just raises the question, might that be the reality that we're in?
Because
there might be no way to tell from the inside.
There is no way to tell, but it seems like it would be quite an elaborate setup when you think of how many players there are in this world, down to like the very microscopic ants. You know what I mean? I mean, everything has to be simulated. If it's you can't have like part simulated world and part not, right?
Well, you can try, but you're going to get in trouble. You know, I once saw this movie, The 13th Floor.
I love that movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, well, you know, in that movie, it turns out they just simulate Southern California. And then the guy gets in a car and starts driving towards Las Vegas. At a certain point, the road says, "Close for repair. Go no further." And he keeps going, and eventually the mountains turn into faint green lines.
I remember that. Well, you know what's interesting is that, I mean, a really clever way to do that would be obviously to implant the memories and not, you know, I think that, you know, there exists all this big production, you know, that someone would have to simulate, when in reality, it's much smaller than that. I just have the memories of it, right?
Yeah, although what happens when you try to go there, you know, you get on a plane to...
Yes.
For a while, they just simulated Australia. Then I went to New York for the first time. I flew to New York, and it's like, oh, shit, now we got to simulate New York.
Well, if we don't have free will, you know, I mean, if we really... I mean, the implication of the fact that if we live in this kind of world is that, I mean, we really don't have free will, right, in that world.
So, we could have free will. We could.
Oh, really?
It's possible.
I don't
think it's inconsistent with free will. We could be living in a simulated universe, but still be making our own decisions about what to do in that universe.
That's a great point. I as soon as almost as I came out of my mouth, I then wanted to take it back because I then thought about like, you know, what about genetic algorithms that we use with computers and stuff, you know, or learning, you know, machine learning and stuff. It's not like we, in a way, machines have free will when we, you know, just program in probabilities and they kind of learn themselves.
I mean, you might think that if our brain is part of the simulation, then that's worse. Then somehow, you know, we're going to be computers too, so we won't have free will. But it's not obvious what's worse about a computer here compared to just, you know, the kind of computers that our brains are. You know, either whether our minds are implemented in physical brains or on computers, you know, maybe they're both deterministic and maybe there's a worry about free will in either case. But it's not clear why it's worse to have a silicon computer for a mind than to have a biological brain for a mind where free will is concerned.
Yeah, and you have a very interesting take on consciousness. And, you know, most people, when they say they're a dualist, people kind of laugh at them, you know, like, or they kind of say, in academia, you know, they're like, or especially, and I should even be clear, I say neuroscientists laugh at them. you're a unique kind of dualist, right?
Yeah, well, dualism means many different things. I think when many neuroscientists hear dualism, they think, you know, something like there's a soul interacting with the brain that will survive your death and so on. I'm a dualist in a much weaker sense in that I think consciousness is an irreducible property of the brain or of ourselves, one that can't fully be explained in terms of underlying goings-on in the brain and ordinary physical processes. But this is something we're used to in the physical sciences. We take some things as fundamental, like space and time and mass and charge. I think consciousness has to be taken as fundamental too. Now, this is very controversial. You know, plenty of people disagree. But at the same time, I don't think there's anything remotely unscientific about this view, and it's totally consistent with all the work going on right now in the science of consciousness.
No, I agree. Well, I recently had an interesting chat with Dr. Siegel, who talked about how the mind is not, you know, purely in our skull. He very much is this believer in the mind as being this integrated flow of information that is deeply connected to the universe. And this is a scientist saying this. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a place actually where a bunch of my different views and interests intersect. Because, yeah, number one, I think the brain could be computational. Number two, I think consciousness may be irreducible. But number three, in another line of work, I'm very much interested in the idea that the mind is partly a product of the environment. And this is something that Andy Clark and I called the extended mind, where our interactions with the environment around us, often parts of our environment play the role of parts of our mind, as in the case where, for example, you know, phone numbers in my smartphone's memory is taking over the role of my biological memory. I now remember phone numbers with my phone rather than with my brain memory. So, you know, my environment there, here my smartphone, is becoming literally part of my mind. And I think that's consistent with this idea of integrating the brain with the environment.
I think so. You know, but just from like a personal perspective, when I have existential dread, it's not comforting to me to know that when my brain stops functioning and therefore this form of consciousness no longer exists, even if my iPhone or all the things I've created or all the extensions of me still continue, I will not. There's an I that will never be aware of that. Is it so? That's not. How comforting is that to me?
I think that's right. I mean, at least insofar as the extended mind hypothesis is concerned, there's always you, the conscious biological being, at the center. And the claim would not be that the iPhone has a mind itself. The claim would be that it's kind of an extension of your mind that extends your capacity. But if your brain was to die, then the iPhone going on, that wouldn't be much comfort for you. To get something a bit more comforting, we might move to a slightly different scenario and think about the possibility of uploading your brain onto a computer. We can't do that yet, but just say eventually we could record all the information in your brain and the connections among all the neurons and their states and activation patterns, and gradually, you know, load them into a computer one at a time until, you know, for a while you were 90% brain and 10% computer, and then 50-50, then 10-90, and ultimately 100% computer. Well, that's a kind of gradual uploading process. And some people, including me, are sympathetic with the idea that you could survive that process. And at the end of that, you might really be there. That wouldn't so much be extending the mind as uploading the mind. But since our focus here seems to be, you know, technology of all sorts, that might be one way to use technology to achieve some kind of immortality.
Well, my gosh, that is, you raised so many interesting questions with that little thought experiment there. You know, of course, you know, the plank by plank, you know, issue about what extent do we cease being who we are, right? And yeah. I mean that I would be very interesting to like self experiment on myself with that. Because I feel like, you know, analogous is like when we start getting dementia, it's almost like when our brain starts breaking down, when we get really old, it's kind of a natural experiment of what happens, you know, kind of plank by plank when you lose that. I feel like once I start feeding that into the system, there will be a certain point where I really do no longer feel as though I am myself. And then I will lose awareness. Eventually I'll lose awareness of myself. So, and then even though it's fed all to the computer, I'm just critical that what I'm feeding to the computer there, like the computer kind of is taking over that consciousness.
What if we stipulate that the computer chips are playing exactly the same role in your cognitive system that the neurons were playing? So maybe you wouldn't even notice the difference, and you keep behaving exactly the same way in that same wonderful old Scott way that we're all used to. You'll carry on doing your podcast with your computer brain, and the listeners aren't going to be able to tell the difference. You won't be able to tell a difference from the inside. But in that case, might you be prepared to say it's still you?
That's so interesting, because I mean, what is the objective truth? I mean, is that just an illusion? You know, like, I mean, we technically, I'm definitely not this. I'm a completely different person than I was when I was 10 from a cellular level, right? So you could make the case that it's an illusion that I'm the same person that I was when I was 11, right?
Some people think it's an illusion that we're the same person from moment to moment.
No, you know, so that's where it gets interesting.
Or maybe every night when we go to sleep, you know, we become unconscious, and then in the dawn, a new consciousness breaks, you know, a new consciousness breaks open, a new person is born every day.
I mean, that's a very interesting proposition, but it doesn't seem consistent with some facts. Like when I wake up in the morning, I have a great continuity of memories that I had the day before.
Okay, memories help, but you know, I could create a teleporter duplicate of me who remembers being me the previous day but isn't me.
But who's creating, you know, who's creating that? I mean, are we back to the simulation idea here again? Like I think we're giving something too much credit there. You know, for that, it doesn't, you know, my point of though is that doesn't seem most parsimonious. I mean, a lot of these thought experiments.
Yeah. It's a simpler view that we're the same person who continues over time. And most people don't really believe that we change our identities from day to day. But I think for similar reasons, most people think the most parsimonious view is that we continue over our lifetime despite the change in matter. And extending that, it's then tempting to say the most parsimonious view is if I uploaded my brain gradually and continuously to a computer, then I could continue that way.
So I don't know if – I mean, this is so interesting. I don't know if the best solution is to gradually do it then. I almost feel like for that continuity, I'd want to be one big dump immediately to kind of just jump, snap into this new state. I think once it's gradual, I feel like it just is not going to feel, it's going to be very confusing.
How do you feel about the case, though, if we do it non-gradually?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the case where we keep the old brain around, still functioning, and upload it onto a computer, and there's a new person there, too?
No,
is
I mean,
one of them new?
Right. The great question. I was actually just going to pose like the 50-50 thing, but you know, like that, like I get 50% on the computer, and we know that 50% is enough. All you need for a consciousness to emerge, and that, but I like your thought experiment better, where it's 100-100.
Yeah.
Now that's fascinating, and I my gosh, what would be the case there? I mean, it's not like you've duplicated yourself, but you know, you've duplicated your consciousness. You know, we can kind of duplicate, you know, it's funny when you have like marriage, people who are married after a certain amount of years, they start looking the same. They started talking the same. And in a sense, little by little, when you're married, you're like duplicating consciousness with two people.
Mm-hmm. Or, still two people, though. You're still two separate people in sync with each other. So likewise, you and your twin would probably, your uploaded twin would probably rapidly become two people. You'd be in different environments, having different experiences. But maybe it would be as if you had suddenly become twins or something. Hey, here's my twin right over there. Here's uploaded Scott. He's just like me.
Yeah, I could see that.
He's not me.
You know, because, well, yeah, it, clearly this stuff is not operating at a purely genetic level, because we know identical twins are often very different in lots of key ways. They don't have the same, and a very different consciousness emerges. So we can't, like, just plank by plank transfer over genes and expect to get the same thing. This is why this is a really, really tricky issue, because even from a neuroscience perspective, you can't just completely replicate someone's neuronal structure of their brain and expect to get the same consciousness and memories out of the person, right?
Maybe eventually, you know, they are working on this brain mapping project, and not even close yet, but I think one of the aims of the project is to eventually be able to map the activity of all the neurons in the brain and all the connections via the Connectome project and so on. So who's to say that maybe eventually we couldn't map the whole state, and maybe even further after that, get the whole thing up and running on a computer?
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for supporting the Psychology Podcast. We're trying to improve the experience for our listeners, so I'd really appreciate it if you'd go onto the show notes for this show and click on the link for the survey and fill out some of the information there. It'll really help us make the show better for you guys. So thanks again, and enjoy the rest of this podcast.
Yeah, who knows? Hey, I'm keeping an open mind. I'm certainly not.
Yeah, it's not going to happen in the next 10 years or the next 20, but eventually, who knows?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, a lot of this raises some fascinating questions about will cryogenics ever be successful. You know, there are people that are freezing themselves in the hopes that someday they will be able to that's the hope, right? Or the hope is that they'll find some sort of medical way to solve something that we don't currently have. But I think a lot of people are hoping that you'll be frozen so that, like, even if it takes like 20,000 years from now,
cryogenics is a kind of intermediate stopgap. You know, right now the technology is not ready, but just freeze my brain well enough and maybe eventually the technology will be ready to unfreeze me. I mean, one worry is that right now the technology is not good enough even to do freezing properly, and probably a lot of information is being lost in the freezing process. But
yeah,
I suppose people are just hoping that enough information is kept around that in that, you know, 1,000 years time or whatever, some really smart super intelligence of the future will be able to reconstruct us. My advice is always, hey, well, don't just leave your brain around, leave a bunch of books and, you know, videos of you and tapes and so on, so they have all the information they possibly can about you, and then they can try and reconstruct you from that.
I love that idea. Have you ever thought about getting that done?
Yeah, could you make sure we leave this podcast in the cryogenic chamber with me? That way, and same for you, and then we'll have these two.
Well, do you want to be in the same chamber with me?
Psychologist reconstructed.
Do you want to be in the same chamber with me?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. Then who are they going to wake up first?
Well, I think that, you know, that it certainly is very optimistic that, like, we'll ever. I mean, it doesn't look like humanity is going in a direction right now where we're going to, like, you know, that will be the case. Look, I sound very pessimistic right now, which I know is not good for a positive psychologist, but I don't, you know, with everything that's going in the world right now, I think it's much more likely that, I don't know, just 20,000 years from now, are we going to reach a point where there's this great utopia and that it's like, oh yeah, sure, we're going to remember these people from 20,000 years ago and try to resuscitate them.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot of ways things can go wrong. You know, I mean, I think we're entering a danger period right now at the human level and at the international level. But, you know, a few years down the line, there's going to be any number of other. I mean, short term, there's nuclear weapons. Longer term, there's climate change. But longer term after that, there's all kinds of existential risks to the whole human race, including the possibility of artificial intelligence. And whether we might develop AIs that somehow take over the world and then lead to bad consequences. You know, there are a lot of people thinking about how we can negotiate all these things in the right way. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are, but I do think there's plenty of ways things can go wrong.
Plenty of ways. So that's an interesting question. What do you think about the singularity idea that Kurzweil, he puts a sestimate really in his own lifetime?
I like to separate the whole singularity idea of artificial superintelligence. You know, there's the idea of AIs getting to be smarter than humans, and then there's claims about the time frame. To me, the most interesting claims aren't the ones about the time frame. Yeah, Ray Kurzweil and others sometimes say, it's just 20 or 30 years off. My own view is that's very implausible. AI actually moves very slowly. I mean, lately there's been a big bubble of excitement about AI because of deep learning, but it hasn't really corresponded to a fundamental advance. It's really been more about the technology crossing a certain threshold where it's suddenly become useful. And there's still huge gaps to be crossed of a level of understanding cognition until we get to anything like a human level, artificial general intelligence. You know, so maybe it's 100 years, who knows? Maybe it's 50 years, maybe it's 100 years. But for me, the interesting question is what happens next? Once you get to a human level AI, pretty soon after that, just by steady improvements, you're going to get to a better than human level AI that's more capable than we are. Then it's going to be, among other things, better at creating AIs than we are. So it's going to be able to create an AI smarter than itself. And that one will be able to create an AI smarter than itself. And this is where we get to what some people call the intelligence explosion, the idea that there'll be a rapid path from human level AI to super intelligence, something way beyond what we can comprehend. And this sounds like science fiction, but a few years ago, 2010, I wrote a paper on this trying to subject it to philosophical analysis. And I came to the conclusion that there's actually a pretty plausible argument here, one we should take seriously. So I do think we should take very seriously the idea that we'll eventually get to human level AI, and not long after that, there's the possibility of something way beyond us.
Yes, I think that is true. And what I envision is that the first stage of this is that humans will be using machines to kind of augment themselves. So it won't be such a separation between, like, you know, machines taking over yet. It's almost like humans who are part machine, part human kind of taking over.
Well, this is already happening via this kind of extended mind thesis I talked about. Our smartphones and Google and so on, those are already augmenting us and augmenting our intelligence in all kinds of ways, making us much more capable and knowledgeable than we were before. I suspect in a few years, once we have, for example, once everyone is wearing augmented reality glasses that are recognizing things in our environment with AI and feeding us all kinds of information and AI advice, then we're going to turn. There was this great book, science fiction novel by Charles Stross, Accelerando, where he called these things the exospecs. Everyone uses their artificially intelligent exospecs. One guy has his exospec stolen, then he turns into a gibbering wreck. He just can't function anymore. To me, that's a realistic future. We'll come more and more to rely on these devices, and we will ourselves be augmented, partially artificial intelligences for some period before we get to fully autonomous AI.
For sure. And then what it's going to do for medicine, I think, is going to be huge. I think it's going to increase our life extension in the sense that, you know, we'll have artificial hearts, you know, we'll have artificial, you know, bit by bit, we're going to start, because we're already starting to see that now. And you can kind of take that to the nth degree, right?
Yeah. Artificial eyes, artificial ears, artificial nerves, artificial neurons. You know, people have worked on neuromorphic retinas and so on. Before long, it's going to be at the level of the neurons, and, you know, at some point, I don't know when exactly, at some point people are going to start seriously thinking about this idea of the, you know, the prosthetic implants in the brain.
Yeah, no, I think that's inevitable. And, you know, I think just moving forward many years, history, people will look back on a certain epoch of humanity that was a new form of human evolution. You know, like, we haven't seen or really can't imagine, although I feel like me and you are kind of imagining it right now, there will be this epoch of humanity where there is this new form of evolution that just that Darwin never could have ever even imagined, you know, because it's not organic evolution. It's not purely human evolution, I should say. It's a new kind of evolution where it kind of becomes like this interesting arms race of who and what countries can have the greatest augmented technology.
Yeah, I do think computer technology here is basically the game changer compared to anything that came before, because computer technology basically enables you to create simulated or artificial versions of almost anything you like. It allows you to create artificial minds, as we're seeing, you know, in this discussion about AI. Yeah. And it also allows us to create artificial worlds, you know, simulated worlds, virtual reality worlds. So it's easy to imagine that at some point, you know, A, most of the people around are going to be artificial minds, and B, those people may to some very large extent be inhabiting artificial or virtual worlds. After all, why restrict us to this one world with all of its limits and specificity when there could be an infinite number of virtual worlds to explore? It's easy to imagine, you know, even if we're not already simulated, then there's going to be a vast future of simulated universes ahead of us.
No, I think that's right. You know, if we are, I keep going back to this idea, if we are simulated, how did you arrive to these, you said between 10 and 50% and you changed. I don't know if you're being tongue-in-cheek there, or do you actually, like, what's going into this calculus?
I don't know. There's this nice argument by Nick Bostrom that maybe we are in a simulation, and it's a probabilistic argument. The naive way to put it is that, look, we know that any advanced civilization is going to have the capacity to create a whole lot of simulated universes, so that ultimately there'll be way more simulated universes than unsimulated universes, and way more simulated people than unsimulated people. Maybe 99% of all the people in the universe, all the conscious beings in the universe, will be simulated, and only 1% will be non-simulated. And then you turn around and say, well, then what are the odds that I am unsimulated? What are the odds that I'm one of the lucky 1%? And presumably you go, well, maybe only 1 in 100. So it should be 99% likely that I'm simulated. But then you think, well, there's a couple of loopholes in that argument. Maybe, for example, it could turn out that almost no super intelligent civilizations will choose to create simulations. They may decide not to. Or maybe they'll all kill themselves off before they get to the ability of creating simulations. Or maybe for some reason simulated universes are impossible. So there's a few loopholes here, what I call simulation blockers. Maybe we'll die. Maybe we can't do this. Maybe we'll choose not to. But then, so maybe the conclusion is disjunctive. Either most beings are simulated or one of these other things happens. So following that reasoning, then we say maybe, okay, I don't know which of those possibilities is the most likely, but it still looks like, you know, maybe at least 20, 25% were in a simulation and 20, 25% for all the others. That's one way to get there. A bit of spurious mathematics for you.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that answer, actually. That helped me understand better what is going into that calculus. So I feel like there's lots of things that, is it possible that lots of these things that we do as humans are kind of like pissing off the simulators, like we're kind of like cheating the system in a way, like, you know, like what if like we were meant to die at age 100 and you know, we in some way that like the computer goes berserk if we do actually figure out this way of living much longer, or that we do things with technology where we start simulating things our own selves, and then I mean couldn't like we be messing or tempting fate in a way?
Yeah, it all depends on the motives and motivations of the simulators, and it's very hard to figure that out. It's almost like a theological position we're in. These simulators are our gods. They created our universe, and now we're trying to figure out their character, to figure out how best to please them. You know, should I be good the rest of my life so I get uploaded into the afterlife or what? You're saying, okay, well, you know, maybe they care about this, maybe they care about that. Well, here's another possibility. Maybe they've just created a million universes overnight. They're running for just a whole bunch of – just for a scientific experiment. And they're going to let them all run, and in the morning they're going to gather statistics. And this is something they do as a matter of course in their labs every day. And they couldn't care less what we get up to. Right. We're just part of some giant impersonal experiment for them. Then all the appeals we – all the praying we like to God isn't going to help. We might as well just live our lives.
Well, that's very possible. And you know, what do you make about the universe and its its scope is so enormous, and you think, you know, there was this point where it all started with a little tiny point, a little dot, right? You know, before it started expanding. And it's just fascinating to just think to yourself, like, what was before that? And what like, what's the point? Like, what, like, why did that ever exist? You know, and like, you know, if time didn't exist before that, fine, you know, that's fair enough, you know, but why, you know, I mean, these are like fundamental questions of human existence, but
the simulation hypothesis doesn't answer those questions. It just pushes it back a bit. Why do we exist? Because the simulator created us. Okay, great. Well, now,
who created the simulator?
Why does the simulator exist? I mean, of course, this is an exact parallel of what you get with traditional questions about God. Absolutely. Some people want to explain the universe. Why do we all exist? Because God created us. Well, great. Well, that just now pushes back the question to God. How did God ever get there? So, you know, philosophers don't have really good answers to these questions. I'm not sure anybody does.
I was hoping you had the answer.
Let me tell you my pet theory of everything, Scott. Yeah.
But it's still fun to talk to you about this stuff. Like, and just imagine what the different possibilities are. What are the different possibilities when we die, right? I mean, is it possible that, like, this consciousness does wake up in something that's like, oh, and I'm told that I was in a simulation? Is that possible?
Look, my inclination is to think that our brains are needed for our consciousness, and as we die, probably our consciousness will die. But, you know, if we are in a simulation, then the possibilities start to get more interesting. If we are in a simulation, then our brains are basically a bit of software, correspond to a bit of software running on a computer. And if the simulators so chose, they presumably could choose that when people's biological bodies die, then they somehow upload all that information from the brain, they extract that software, and they put it in some other environment. Maybe, for example, they would use it to control some new body up in their own world. And for us, that could be experienced, I suppose, as something like moving to an afterlife, taking part in some kind of different universe, maybe even some kind of heaven. There was actually a Black Mirror episode about this. In the recent new batch that was pretty good. I'm not saying that's the way it is going to go. I'm saying that's one way it could go. If we are in a simulated universe, that does raise interesting quasi-theological possibilities. So, you know, maybe it just raises a tiny bit of hope for immortality and an afterlife, even from a completely naturalistic perspective. So one of the interesting things that for me, I've always been completely atheistic and not much sympathy for any kind of religion, but it is interesting to see how this idea of simulation technology can start to reinstate some fairly traditional theological questions in a quite different naturalistic guise.
Yeah, no, I totally see that. You know, as you're describing this, it sounds exactly like these ideas we've created of the afterlife. What are some other burning questions that you have these days? You have a lot.
I've been thinking a lot about technology in general and its impact on philosophy. You know, some people, and on life more generally, you know, some people are very techno-negative. They think that it's got all kinds of doom and gloom consequences. I tend to be techno-positive. I love technology, you know, virtual reality technology, AI technology, the internet. There's all kinds of wonderful things, although, of course, it can be abused as well as used. Lately, I've got myself a whole lot of virtual reality tools to play around with. In my office, in my study, I've got a Oculus Rift and a HTC Vive and a Samsung Gear VR, and I've been playing around.
Which one do you like best?
You know, I think so far the HTC Vive, although that's got this very cool room scale virtual reality with motion controllers. Although I just got the new controllers for the Oculus Rift called Oculus Touch, and I still need to set those up. But anyway, it's been amazing to play around with all this virtual reality, and it raises all kinds of questions about the metaphysics, the ontology of the worlds in virtual reality. For example, are these just hallucinations? Are they unreal worlds? Or is this some kind of real reality that we're interacting with in VR? And, you know, I'm actually inclined towards a view where virtual reality is a real reality. It's a reality made of computers. It's digital, but it's still real for all that, which I think goes against the most common philosophical view, where it's some kind of illusion or fiction.
David, I have been thinking, I'm so glad you said that, and I have been saying to people that I think that human imagination is real in some sense as well.
That is interesting. I mean, you can make an interesting parallel from this. I just read a paper by someone saying, well, maybe dreams, maybe hallucinations are analogous to virtual reality in this respect. And then once you say, you know, if a dream can do this, if hallucination can do this, why not? Yeah. Imagination. Of course, imagination is to some extent under our control in a way in which what happens in the VR is not. So it's not as independent of us. Some people think mind independence, you know, independence of us is a strong condition on something being fully real. So maybe the imagination is just somewhere on the spectrum. But I think, you know, maybe still this, to some extent our imagination has a certain autonomy.
You know, you said independent.
Daydreaming runs wild.
Yeah, you know, you said independent of us. And I mean, that's interesting because there is so many selves. I mean, it is, there's one sense that there is a simulator in our body that is, you know, simulating, you know, there's particular brain networks that are doing the simulation of the imagination. And there's another part of us that is metacognitively viewing the simulation. So I'm not so sure that that is true, that we, that there isn't a we that is not in control of it.
That seems especially right in the case of dreams, right? There's this dream spinner who, when you're dreaming, you seem to have no access to the dream spinner.
Correct.
They're just doing their thing. With imagination, I don't know, the two parts feel a bit closer together. When I imagine something, it feels like I can control it more than I can control what happens in a dream. But also it does seem to have some autonomy. You know, daydreams will just evolve without me trying to do anything. My mind will wander in different directions. So maybe there's also an imagination spinner who's at least to some extent separate from the agent who's experiencing the imagination themselves.
Yeah.
So you may be right.
Thank you. You're the first person not call me crazy when I say I think imagination I could make an argument that imagination is real in some sense. So what do you play, like when you do the Oculus Rift? Because my parents just bought me I sound like a 5-year-old, don't I? But for Hanukkah, they just bought me the PlayStation 4 VR. VR.
That one I don't have, so I'm interested to hear how that goes.
And I'm very interested to – I haven't tried the other, so I don't know the difference. But what do you play on the Oculus Rift? Like, what do you do with it?
There's all kinds of video games available, you know,
really?
Standard video games, space war games, and first-person shooters, and so on. Now, I am not myself much of a video gamer, so that's not really my thing. So I find myself doing other things, non-gaming apps especially. There's Google Earth on the HTC Vive. That's extremely cool. You can explore the whole Earth, and I can actually go down to my home, get on the balcony of my apartment.
Really?
And so on. It's not quite, you know, I can fly through New York. It's pretty amazing. At the level of human beings and cars and so on, it gets a bit coarse-grained and a bit wonky. But, you know, flying over New York in VR is is pretty amazing. And there's all kinds of cool other little environments you can just inhabit. You can see 360-degree movies. There are environments where you can assemble little contraptions. There are little lab demo games. Right now, it's, you know, people haven't developed really full-scale, rich realities. Or when they have, they've typically been ported from a pre-existing video game. But I think that kind of thing, you know, in the future, it's probably going to be a technology for social networking. Facebook bought out Oculus, and I think that's probably how they see it. In the future, we're going to be doing this podcast, not just audio, not even just video. We're going to hang out in VR, and I'll have an avatar, and you'll have an avatar, and it'll be like we're talking to each other, and someone else wants to come in and listen to the podcast, then they'll just come into the VR with us and watch us talk. Hi, guys.
I imagine a world where it's all beautiful people in virtual world, but because of that fact, people have not spent any time keeping up their looks in the other world. So you have a whole world of like really schlubby looking people like that are all talking to each other looking beautiful.
Yeah, and the beauty is not going to be worth much if everyone can be equally beautiful. We're going to have to find different ways to value people. That's
other fitness indicators from like a, you know, a Darwinian perspective, right? What are going to be the fitness indicators?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just something crappy like intelligence. I don't know. maybe everyone's going to have a super intelligence module too. And after a while, there's got to be no way to differentiate people except little random quirks of personality. And a quirky guy like you, Scott, you know, you're going to be valued as a unique and wonderful resource.
Oh, you just made me blush.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. Well, I sent you this article today, right? With people who try virtual realities environments. It was written by my friend Rebecca Searles, and that article says, you know, shows that like some people experience this dissociative experience where they start to question whether or not the real world is real. You know?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I go into the VR and then I come out, and things do seem a little bit somehow shaky. My hypothesis is something like this. Once you hang out in virtual reality enough, you start perceiving things as virtual. You start to, you know, have a sense that you're in a virtual world. It's not exactly the same as perceiving the physical world. You actually kind of sense things as being virtual. In a mixed reality, for example, you might sense some things as virtual and other things as not. So I think sometimes when you come out of VR and then go into a non-virtual environment, you retain that seeing things as virtual. And even in the physical world, you're seeing some things around you as virtual objects. And your perception is as if you're in a virtual reality,
right,
even though you're not. So I call this the phenomenology of virtuality. Like there's a whole kind of phenomenal sense and appearance and experience of things around us being virtual. And sometimes that can be illusory. You could be in a non-virtual world and still see things as virtual. And I think maybe this virtual derealization that people talk about in the normal world, the post-VR sadness, maybe that's an instance of that kind of an illusion of the phenomenology of virtuality.
Well, just to circle back to the whole beginning of this conversation, you know, I mean, if it is true that we live in a simulation, it's possible. It's just it's like VR that's evolved so great that everything just is this clear as our eyes can see it. But in reality, what I'm in right now, what you're in, you know, is actually just another virtual world, right? Just a better, a more optically.
Yeah. I mean, a good enough virtual reality technology is probably going to be indistinguishable.
Correct.
From a non-virtual world. Right now, of course, it's not. It's pretty
right
coarse
now, it's
grained.
Not.
You get screen door effects, you get pixels, but give it a few years.
Yeah. I could see the thought experiment I think it's realistic that someday we will have virtual reality that is indistinguishable from what our optics can see right now in what we are calling the real world. And I think things are going to get really tricky then, because – and not only tricky, but I actually I want to end this interview by saying I started this interview putting the probability that we live in the Matrix at about 7%. And mm-hmm. And actually now that I'm thinking about this and more and having this conversation with you and realizing that – what I'm seeing right now could potentially be a very evolved simulation. I'm upping my percentage as well.
So where are you now?
I'm going to put it at 27%.
Wow, 26.5. That's getting high. I mean, you're right though. If it's indistinguishable from the inside, there's no way for us to decisively tell one way or another. So a lot's going to rest on your prior probabilities that, you know, these simulated universes are going to be created or they're not. And the more you think about it, the more it could start to seem kind of likely that they might be created. And then you start, at one point I did a debate recently about this topic and I put it at 42%. You know, so maybe that's a stable stopping point.
What we need to get at some point are about, you know, like our margins of error are around these numbers.
Yeah, well, that's why I said 10 to 50. You know, it's probably hard to do better than, you know, one significant digit on these things. Maybe even that's too much. But, you know, the fact that it's significantly greater than zero is already
That's huge.
Where a lot of interest lies.
That's huge. Hey, yeah. It's always great chatting with you, Dave, and I really appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Thanks. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barrett-Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.